Welcome to Inside Seaweed, the podcast looking deep into the seaweed industry through the stories of pioneers, entrepreneurs, and innovators. I'm Fed the Gobby, and today dialing in from Sabah in Southeast Asia is Simon Davis. He is the founder of Seedling, a seaweed biotechnology company that pioneers farming with cutting-edge technologies and create products such as functional ingredients for pet food. Perhaps more importantly, though, Simon is an experienced entrepreneur with deep knowledge of the seaweed sector in Southeast Asia, which is what made this interview an eye-opener for me, and I hope you'll learn something too. Here it goes. Simon, it's a pleasure to have you here. How are you doing?
Doing great, Ted. Thanks for letting me on board.
No, my pleasure. Before we dive in, there is something we need to address simply to satisfy my curiosity. So this one's for me. In 2012, you took a two-year career break to fulfill a lifelong dream, which turned into what you described as a six-year odyssey. Please tell me more.
Yeah. So I've always been a person who loves the ocean. I've always been a passionate, you know, sailor, diver, fisherman. And I'd always had the dream of sailing around the world. And I ended up buying a yacht and setting out to go sail, and starting in the Caribbean, then across the Pacific Ocean, then throughout Southeast Asia. And it was an incredible journey and very, very special, and was originally going to be 2 years turned into 6 years because it was so incredible. But interestingly, it was that trip that led me to seaweed.
In what way?
On that trip, I spent a lot of time in the ocean. You know, I spent a lot of time visiting remote places, visiting remote people, whether in the Pacific or whether in Southeast Asia. And I got to see firsthand the damage that's been happening to the ocean. You know, whether it's overfishing or whether it's pollution or whether it's, you know, destruction of coral. And, you know, of course, I'd read about that. We've all, you know, heard about it, but I got to see it firsthand. I got to see, you know, ecosystems that were at their limit. I got to sit down with villagers and speak with people and just see the challenges they're having. People aren't catching as much fish anymore. Been to, you know, remote parts of the ocean and seen whole fleets of fishing ships out there emptying it. And as part of that, I started getting very upset and about how unsustainable it was. And I started working, we're doing marine conservation with some communities in Indonesia and spending a lot of time with these remote communities. That got me thinking to, okay, setting up a national park or a marine protected area is so important, but if there's not some sort of livelihood option for these people, then there's nothing that's going to really be impactful. There's nothing that can be sustainable and can scale. So I started looking for, okay, what industries, what occupations out there are there that can really support a healthy ocean, particularly for in the developing world? And that's where I first came across seaweed.
So your focus was very much toward the fishing community in those areas and how to create a livelihood for them.
Yeah, so I was spending a lot of time in Indonesia, the Solomon Islands and Philippines, all of which are major seaweed producers. And so I was looking at all different options for what communities could do to earn a living that was healthy for the ocean. And so I came across seaweed, and that was really interesting to me. So I started reading up on it. And at first it was through the perspective of starting, like, you know, community programs of seaweed farming. But I started reading more and more and reading journals, and I zoomed out. And instead of it just being a community farming program, I could see this is a new form of agriculture. Instead of farming crops on land, we're just farming crops in the ocean. And that got me extremely, extremely excited to be able to have an industry where you're creating biomass for food, for plants, for materials, for fuels, that was scalable, that used zero fresh water, that didn't use chemicals, and at the same time, increased ocean biodiversity and captured carbon. That just blew me away. But at the same time, the industry was very, very low tech. There was a lot of innovation that needed to happen. So I started attending conferences around the world. I started visiting different businesses and learning more about the seaweed industry. And I could see the opportunity. But then I...
What time is this? Sorry to jump in. What, when you sort of, you discover this this new form of agriculture, like you said, you found out about it and it was a bit of a eureka moment. And then you looked at this landscape around you and saw that it was kind of low tech and under research. What time is this? What year?
That was 8 years ago. I started reading into it 8 years ago. Started reading into it, traveling a lot to different conferences. But then I really wanted to... So I spent 2 years researching seaweed industry before I launched my company. And of that, I spent the majority of time actually going out and staying with seaweed farmers. It's particularly in our part of the world in Southeast Asia, it's very hard to get really detailed information about what is happening in the real world. Fortunately, I was on a yacht, so I could travel anywhere. I speak Indonesian and Malay. So I spent literally a couple of years sitting around with seaweed farmers in remote parts of the world, drinking coffee and talking about seaweed and talking about the weather and talking about their challenges and what was successful. And you know, these were people who had been farming for 20, 30, 40, even 50 years. And spending 2 years of that, I gained a very deep understanding about the opportunities and the challenges.
What were some of the biggest takeaways from that period?
The biggest takeaways is that the industry is extremely inefficient in Southeast Asia, extremely, extremely inefficient. And there's been next to zero innovation in 50 years. In 50 years, you've got farmers who are still planting the same seed material, using the same techniques to make the same products. And it's very, very basic. You know, these are mostly people who are very poor. They don't have an education. Many of them don't even have a smartphone. They'll be paddling out in a canoe and planting seaweed, you know, drying in the sun, and then you're packing it and shipping it off to a distant shipper. And along the supply chain, it's very, very opaque. There's a number of blocks that happen there, and that's stopped innovation trickling down into the industry. You know, farmers will trade with multiple middlemen before the raw material ends up with an end processor. And what this has meant is that the farmers, being very poor, they don't have the ability to innovate, and the processors don't have an incentive to innovate because they're not linked with the farming process at all.
Yeah, there is a big gap, isn't there, between something that, you know, a very important element often missing from the seaweed dialogue in Europe and North America, and that's Asia. And so a lot of what you just said will sound potentially strange or new and alien to a lot of people that might be listening. You, on the other hand, you have 8 years of hands-on experience working on this, working in the industry in Southeast Asia. I would like, with your help, to try and fill that gap, if you're happy to. You already started in a way, I feel. I'm not sure where to go because there's so much to unpack. But you sort of painted a situation of what, as I understand, is the current situation over there. And what would you see as the key differences between the Western and Eastern seaweed industry?
There's many differences. I'm going to focus more on Southeast Asia as opposed to, say, you know, China, Japan, Korea, because this is the part of Asia that I know the best. The scale here is significant. In our region alone, say, Malaysia, Indonesia, Philippines, there's more than 1 million seaweed farmers, and they've been farming for decades. For example, just in the region where we are, just a small town where we work with our groups of farmers, they produce more seaweed in 1 month than all of Europe and North America does in 1 year. That's just one town. The ability to grow biomass in this part of the world is just immense. On top of that, you've got very supportive government, because seaweed's been here for so long. Governments are very, very supportive. There's no restrictions on, you know, water usage or permits. Very, very supportive here. Things move very fast. Supply chains are already in place. Logistics is already in place. Yeah, the scale is just significant. But like I said, it's very, very basic. We're talking about very, very simple people with very, very limited resources out there growing seaweed. So where I see the opportunity is that when, you know, you've got all this tremendous capacity, but it's been done incredibly inefficiently. What can we do if we inject in some innovation? Even the smallest changes, imagine the change that we can create in this part of the world.
And do you feel the lack of innovation and the possible opportunity lies especially on the cultivation side, so on the water, or is it across the whole supply chain? Because you mentioned the supply chain exists, it's quite established, but does it need innovation technology through processing and so on?
There's opportunity for innovation all through the supply chain, absolutely in cultivation. You know, the varieties that they're farming at the moment haven't changed in 40 or 50 years, and they're declining in performance. The work we're doing at Seedling to identify high performance varieties is a game changer. It's an absolute game changer. The product applications for the seaweeds, that the eucumatoids that we farm in this part of the world, it's only used for one application, which is carrageenan. There's so many other applications that we can use, whether it's in an animal feed product like what we're doing at Seedling, or whether it's in, you know, a bioplastic. And then furthermore, there's so many new opportunities for new species and varieties that haven't been commercialized yet. We're based in Borneo, which is one of the most biodiverse places on this planet. You know, Borneo is famous for its rainforests and coral reefs. And just like there's tremendous biodiversity in the forest, there's tremendous biodiversity in the ocean. And we see huge opportunities to tap into this natural richness and uncover new species and new applications for the native species of seaweed.
Where do we go from here? There's so much, isn't there?
There really is.
I'm thinking from the point of view of, okay, we can do both. From the point of view of the local industry, what is needed, and do you feel these needs will be fulfilled by local businesses and local innovators, or is there a need for external, maybe Western entrepreneurs and innovators, scientists potentially coming in and helping out in some way?
It has to be driven by local people, but at the same time, we need to all work together on this. It needs to be a combination of local communities, of private companies, of industry, of academics, of scientists, and the government working together to really create a successful solution. And you know, there's lots of ways that all of these different partners can come together to do this. We've been very successful in what we've been doing because we've spent a lot of time in this part of the world. I've lived more than 15 years in Southeast Asia. The majority of my company are from this region. And so that we really understand how to operate here, because Asia is very complex and you need to understand how it works. You know, for example, classically, within a country, there's so many different ethnic groups, and each of them will operate differently. And each of them will have different languages, different ways of doing things. And if you're, say, seaweed farming in Indonesia is not all the same. How they farm in one part of Indonesia is very, very different to how they farm in the other. So if you're operating in different areas, you need to be very aware of this, both in terms of the people and the climate. Where we farm in Malaysia, there's two different cultural groups who are farming, and they're very, very different. So we have our scientists who are both from each group of the cultural groups, so we can speak with farmers in their local dialects and develop these very strong relationships with them.
That's fascinating. Of course, the local knowledge that is absolutely needed.
So there's a lot of opportunity here in Asia, but it's not easy.
Yeah, yeah. What do you think, I mean, before we focus too much on what Europe and North America, what role Europe and North America could play in coexisting and cooperating with these realities, I just want to stay a bit more and focus a bit more on Southeast Asia and understand a couple of things. You know, first of all, what are we ignoring or not understanding about this war, this reality? And I say we as in Europeans and North American seaweed industry people. It's very, very broad brush.
I would say that most people I speak to from the seaweed sector in North America and Europe is they don't understand the scale of how seaweed farming is in this part of the world. And I always get a kick about when we have a visitor to take them out to a farm and all you see in all directions is seaweed. It's just immense. It's just absolutely immense. So I'm so supportive. I'm so excited about what's happening in other parts of the world. But a lot of the challenges that are being encountered there, you know, how to set up a farm, how to run it at low cost, how to find customers, set up your supply chain, all of that has already been overcome in this part of the world. So from my perspective, if we can agree that seaweed farming, when done sustainably, is very, very positive, and that the more sustainable seaweed farming we can do, the better this world's going to be, you know, whether it's more material, better impact on ocean, better, you know, income created for people. If we can agree that the more seaweed, the better, then if we're really going to scale it, if we're really going to, you know, 100x the world production of seaweed, then I would say it's going to happen in this part of the world where there already is an ongoing, there's been a long-standing history of seaweed farming. You've got people who know how to do it. You've got year-round sunshine, very stable climate, and a lot of space to expand to. So for me, as I look at the world, you know, it's that band of around the equator, 5 degrees above and below the equator, that going around the world, that is really where we're going to grow tremendous quantities of biomass, or seaweed biomass, in the future.
There's a couple of points I want to pick up. The first one that comes to mind is, are we reinventing the wheel? Are we trying to overcome problems that have already been resolved, and by ignoring knowledge and information that already, techniques or whatever might be the case, that already exists? That's one thing that I'd like to explore.
So there's some differences and there's some lessons that could be applied everywhere. So a classic would be that the species that we farm in Southeast Asia is very, very different to the species that farmed in colder waters like North America or Europe. So the way that you farm them is very, very different. You could say that in that regard, there's some lessons from our part of the world that wouldn't apply to North America. It's like the difference between growing apples versus mangoes. You know, the farming techniques are very, very different. But then on the other hand, you look at farming in China, which is the world's largest producer by a long, long way. And once again, with a long, long history of farming. And I believe we can learn a lot from that. I believe that there's a huge opportunity in learning from the seaweed industry in China that the rest of the world could learn from. I look at a lot of the conferences or panels around the world. And when you look at the number of people on them, there's very few people from Asia, and particularly from China. It's a bit like, you know, going to a conference on the IT industry, but there's no one from Silicon Valley. And I see a lot of opportunity for us to bridge with scientists, with companies in China, which is the number one by a long way, and learn from that.
Why are we not? What's the obstacle?
Yeah, great question. I think the industry in China is a little bit separated. They kind of keep to themselves, but it's definitely possible. We've got some very good relationships with Chinese researchers and companies.
From a very tactical perspective, or very sort of hands-on perspective, is there any approach that has worked well for you in terms of bridging that gap and talking to China or learning from that part of the world and that area of the industry?
So as a company, we prioritize relationships and building relationships. And whether it's about locally here in Malaysia or across the Southeast Asia region or across the whole Asian region or across the world, we really prioritize in developing relationships, which takes time and takes a lot of effort. But I suppose it's something that I've been doing for a long time. As I said, I've been living in Southeast Asia for more than 15 years. So working in this part of the world is kind of natural for me. It's kind of home.
You might not even know what is the secret sauce. You might not even realize it.
It's culture. It's just being aware of people and developing good relationships.
Okay. I did say there was another element, because you raised a lot of interesting points and I want to make sure we don't lose them. So coming back to a few of the things you said, you would see as the area of highest potential for seaweed cultivation, essentially the area around the equator, 5 degrees north, 5 degrees south. A lot of energy in terms of investment, development, research is going in areas that are in much colder waters, much further up north. Is that a waste of time? Are we neglecting, you know, from a, say, 80-20 principle perspective, are we focusing on the wrong side of that coin, and why?
I absolutely support the developments and the investment going into seaweed industries in North America and Europe and Australia and other parts of the world. I think it's very, very important. I see there will be different opportunities in different parts of the world for different things, whether it's about making growing different species to make different types of products. Once again, I see this as agriculture, but on the ocean. So we're growing crops with different purposes in different parts of the world. So absolutely, you know, there needs to be effort worldwide. But for me, if the objective is about growing a lot of biomass, then the place that is easiest to do that will be around the equator, where the environment is the most stable. The reason I say 5 degrees above and below the equator is because, you know, that's the area where hurricanes don't come into. You know, above and below that, you get hurricanes. So it's very, very stable in that band. And that will continue in the future. So if we're growing a lot of biomass, you've got the people who know how to farm it, and you've got the ideal climate, and you've got year-round sunshine and warm weather. So yes, there should be... Plus the supply chain. So yes, there should be investment and innovation and development all around the world, but depending on the priority. If it's really about scaling, then it's going to happen around the equator. It's going to happen in the tropics.
Okay, let's explore that for a second. We're very much looking at the future of this industry. How could this work? What are the most likely directions do you see this industry going? If, for example, we go for scale, how could it happen in the tropics? And maybe, what are the biggest challenges?
We see the greatest opportunity is both, it's two aspects, but really they're interlinked. First of all is improving the cultivation process. By working on the seed material. You've got 1 million farmers out there. Imagine if you put a better quality seed in their hand. Imagine the difference you could make if you put a seed into a farmer's hand that was growing 30, 40, 50% superior than what he's currently using. That lever has tremendous effect. And then secondly is on the applications. We see tremendous opportunity in using seaweeds as additives and ingredients in animal feed. Not necessarily as the prime carbohydrate or protein, but as additives that have performance and health advantages, functional benefits, and in biostimulants, in plant biostimulants as well.
What could some of the listeners hearing this do? And by what I mean by that is any entrepreneurs or people wanting to make a contribution, how could they be part of the vision you just described?
At Seedling, we're always looking for talented people to come and join us. So we need talented researchers, engineers, professionals of all different groups. So please, if you've got any interest in seaweed and you really want to, you know, be impactful, then please reach out and I'm always happy to speak to anyone. And if anyone would like to come to this part of the world and have a look at seaweed farming, I really strongly encourage you to come and, you know, meet the people and see the farms. And there's no shortages of challenges that need to be overcome. There's no shortages of problems that need to be overcome. But you've got to be aware that, you know, it can be challenging in this part of the world also, doing business or getting things done. Yeah.
Understanding the culture, as you said.
Understanding the culture, understanding the people, understanding the complexity here.
Okay, look, from the point of view of the rest of the world, what are the biggest mistakes that Southeast Asia has made and the rest of the world should try and avoid, if there is anything that comes to mind?
I would say it's primarily about having one product application from the species being farmed, which is, you know, hydrocolloids, carrageenans, because the industry has been focused just on this one application. It's essentially fragile. If the market for those products is dominated by a few large companies, and that means that if there's any changes to hydrocolloids or to the manufacturers of them, then it can have tremendous knock-on effects to literally 1 million people, you know, involved in the farming industry. So I understand why. When you've got like a market demand, you just want to grow it as much as you can. That's great. But it's not good business. And if we're talking about an industry that's going to be around for the next 100 years, there needs to be new applications, new product uses for the species of seaweed being farmed.
Okay, so diversification to build some resilience into the system.
Absolutely.
I want to stay a little bit longer on this because I think it would be relevant. What are the most likely directions you see the industry going toward in Southeast Asia? And if it's a repetition, feel free to skip it.
Yes, I would say it's just about new product applications, new species as well. There is starting to be looking at some of the species that are being farmed on a small scale, growing more of those, but really it's going to be about new product applications.
On that, is there anything that entrepreneur on a global scale could do to contribute in that sense? Could, for example, a small business in, I don't know, Germany come up with a new application that would tap into the supply chain?
You could look into the species that are currently being farmed and, you know, applying a biorefinery to it. You know, as an industry, we've been talking about biorefinery for many, many years now, and there's still a long way to go with that. But I would say in cold water species, they're more advanced on developing a biorefinery approach for seaweed species rather than in the tropics. I think that's a real area that can be worked on. Also, for that matter, you know, machinery and engineering. And it doesn't necessarily need to be the same type of engineering that you're looking at in, say, Europe, where I'm seeing these pictures of these big harvesting and seeding boats. It could just be, right now, it's very, very hands-on, very labor-intensive. It could just be, you know, a little piece of machinery that could fit, you know, in the back of a pickup truck or onto a small boat that can have a significant, you know, improvement to the farming practice out here. So there's a lot of opportunity for smaller, impactful innovations. It doesn't need to be a giant seaweed seeding and harvesting vessel. It could be something very, very small.
But within the area of automation and mechanization?
Yeah, or just improving it somewhat. This industry is still run by, you know, a family sitting around tying on seed by their hands onto a rope and using soda bottles as floats, not even using proper floats, and paddling out by hand in a canoe to sit out the lines. There's many ways that that can be improved.
So to sort of summarize it is, would be to sort of start simple and small.
Start very simple and small, and be very aware of the people that you're working with, because say another example would be trading platforms, like online platforms for trading seaweed. I could see how that could work in other countries. But people on the ocean here, a lot of them don't have smartphones. They live out on stilt houses far from land. They might live 10, 20 kilometers from land. They probably don't have internet. Some of them may not be able to read or write. They may not have a bank account.
Okay, so a smart.
Yeah, so have a smart application. Yeah.
Is it going to help, is it?
Yes. Like, you know, a significant portion of the farmers that we work with don't have a passport, so they can't have a bank account. And as well as, you know, the challenges with this, you know, getting electricity, getting connectivity, all this, there's trust issues. People living in these communities, they can be very conservative, and they won't necessarily jump onto an innovation, even if it is superior.
What innovations could they need? What innovations could work in this environment?
The farmers that we all speak to is they want better quality seed. They want secure financing, and they want to have more stable pricing. And when I say stable pricing, to me, that's about expanding demand. So, you know, from multiple industries, multiple applications, so that if one use, you know, for example, hydrocolloids, you know, the market changes, then, you know, the price doesn't affect everyone.
Okay, so it sounds like developing new products that use different species and different ingredients could be really valuable for these areas.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I would say both new species with new applications, but also new applications for the current existing species. So then there's, you know, it's more stable demand. And as well as that, as I mentioned, the financing, that's a big challenge in the industry at the moment. Trying to get financing as a seaweed farmer is very, very hard. So they're affected by middlemen who can charge really high interest rates or can control farmers. And then about the seed material that they're using. Everyone wants faster growing seed and everyone's worried about the future.
Let's dive into that then. Actually, but before we do that, something comes to mind, which is the possibly a completely different topic. How much of a problem is the current lack of clear and consistent quality standards and certifications? If, say, the Nestle or Unilever of the world want to buy big amounts of seaweed biomass, do they have any assurances that the quality is consistent and, I'm going to use the word, certified?
So in terms of consistent quality, there is opportunities for that because, you know, we know different locations will and different times of the year will affect the composition of a crop. At the moment, there's no differentiation in price. And that's probably because the supply chain is so opaque. So the end buyer is just buying seaweed through a middleman and doesn't actually know where it comes from. So they're probably just kind of, you know, pricing it for an average quality. So there's not like a grade A or a grade C. So by breaking down that supply chain and, you know, having some transparency, there's the opportunity to have, you know, different grades of product, of raw material.
Okay, so there is some opportunity there, but not something that you feel as a pain point.
That's only hypothetical. As at the moment, there's no difference in pricing. It's just all about moisture content. That's it. But I could see an opportunity for that going forward. There's not yet, you know, strains of the seaweed in the tropics which have proven to be higher yielding. We're working on that, but there's nothing available at the moment.
One of the pain points that led you to creating your own company, Seedling, as you say, was the general lack of innovation you observed in the industry. What is the role that biotechnologies can play in developing the seaweed industry, whether in Southeast Asia or globally?
So there's no shortage of problems that need to be solved. But from our perspective, when I first founded the company, we saw the biggest opportunity to grow a business was in animal feed ingredients and biostimulants. We saw that as just the best business case. And as well as that, I recognized very early on that if you're going to have a successful business, you've got to have a scalable supply chain. If when we're planning to have a very big business and, you know, dealing with significant volumes of product, if you're just buying your raw seaweed through a supplier, through middlemen, and you cannot guarantee quality, and then you're extremely susceptible to supply issues. So that's why Seedling, as right from the beginning, has invested heavily not only in product development, and we're doing some very innovative things using fermentation to enhance seaweed as an ingredient for animal feed, but not only in the product applications, but investing in the seed varieties, investing in partnerships with farming groups, really deeply investing in our supply chain. Because if we're really going to grow a business, you've got to own your supply chain.
When you say own your supply chain, you don't necessarily mean as in vertical integration, but you mean more understanding it fully?
Yeah, okay. So that's a very clear point. So we don't own our own farms and we don't intend to, because in this part of the world, that can have a lot of risk inherent in it. However, we partner with established farming communities and develop win-win relationships with them, whereby we offer them opportunities to be a dependable trading partner with them. We offer them training in improving the quality of their farming practices, and we offer trainings to the families, whether it's how to reduce the plastic pollution in the farming process, or whether it's giving training on environmentally healthy behaviours for communities who live out at sea. So we develop these very strong partnerships with established seaweed farming communities, which means that we can really guarantee both the quality of the seaweed that we use to create our products, but also a dependable supply for the future.
Understood. Going back to the biotechnologies area for a second. First of all, do you feel that this is an area that has been neglected or overlooked by the industry?
I would say that there could always be a lot more, but there's actually been a reasonable amount of research done on tropical seaweeds over the last couple of decades. Nowhere near as much as what's happened with cold water seaweeds, but there has been, a reasonable amount of research done. However, next to zero has trickled down to the actual industry. So there's been next to zero that's got out of a lab and actually had an impact in a farm. So despite a couple of decades of papers and conferences, the way farmers are farming now is identical to how they were 50 years ago.
Why do you think it hasn't trickled down into the industry? What is the barrier, if any?
I honestly can't say. I don't know. I think it's a combination of a number of factors, whether it's research institutions not being connected enough with seaweed communities, or whether it's seaweed communities not being willing to adopt new things. I would say it's a combination of those two, but I'm not entirely sure.
Combination of the two, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. I realize it's almost 5 where you are. I've left, I think I wasn't ready for so many things to come up. I left a couple of points on the table. We almost need 2 episodes for this. There's so much.
I'm really pleased with how this is going, Fed, because I really want to share what it's like out here, because the information doesn't get it out to the wider community, I feel.
No, you're right. And it's my fault as well, because I haven't explored it properly. And now in hearing all of this, I go, damn, how does all of this stay covered? There's definitely a communication breakdown between, I suppose, oversimplifying it, between the East and the West.
Yeah, I think there's challenges with language, with culture, time zones. To visit a seaweed farm out here, often it can be a long journey, difficult to get to. So there's many, many obstacles.
Just a quick break to remind you of Inside Seaweed newsletter. Would you like to get a super short email from me every month with 3 actionable insights for your seaweed business? I will keep on searching the seaweed industry for the most important lessons, the most useful conclusions, and relevant actions, condensed into a half page that I will share with you each month. It's really easy to sign up and just as easy to cancel. If you'd like to give it a try, head over to insideseaweed.com. Now back to the interview. Among the products and solutions offered by Seedling are feed additives for pets, as you mentioned. What made you focus on that?
We focused on pets, first of all, because with the work that we do with communities and environment, we've got a lot of great information and stories which pet food companies love. And, we're a startup, we're an early stage business. So we have to think about, where's the best place that's going to grow our business, to start off with. We chose pet food because the margins are a bit higher than going for other animal feed. And we've got these great stories about where our seaweed come from and the people who farm it. And that's been very impactful, and our customers are really excited by that. We see pet food as our first step. In the coming years, we'll be expanding our product line to aquaculture, to livestock, to poultry and swine. But for the beginning, pet food's been a great first step for us.
Who are your customers at the moment, and where are they? If I realize a lot of that you might not want to say. So
yeah, so I can't give details, but
yeah, of course.
We're our customers so far are in Europe, UK, and in Southeast Asia. But we just launched in the US in August, and we've got some very exciting partnerships developing there, which is amazing.
That's fantastic to hear. Absolutely. Could you maybe share a little bit? Of course, again, if there's any detail you want to leave out, please do. But I'd be interested to understand how you developed your product or products and how you went about understanding your customer needs. Because, of course, I understand you're an expert in the seaweed industry, but you're not an expert on pet food additives. So how did you go about understanding that side of things?
Yeah, so it's all about having a great team. And at Seedling, we're fortunate enough to have a very talented team with a wide range of expertise. So we started fermenting seaweed after we had our head of product, Bertie Padam, join us. Bertie's background is in food technology. And he's been fermenting natural products, including seaweed, for more than a decade. So he's got very long history in working with this material. And fermenting seaweed on a commercial scale is not easy. It's very difficult. It's easy to do on a lab scale, but when you turn it into a factory, yeah, it's got a lot of challenges. So it took us a couple of years to overcome that. But we're now at a really exciting stage where we can expand our production at will.
All the best with that. I will go back to something you started talking about earlier, which is looking at new species and varieties. So to set the scene, what seaweed species do you work with at the moment? And what, I suppose, are their main characteristics?
So at the moment, we work with eucumetoids, caprophycus, a couple of different species of those, which we're turning into different ingredients for pet health and also for liquid biostimulants. We're also working on Asparagopsis taxiformis, which is for reducing methane in livestock. And we've got a couple other species that we're very interested in, but unfortunately I can't share the details of what they are.
As I understand it, the vast majority, if not all, the species that you work with are within the red seaweed group. Could you share maybe what are some of the advantages and disadvantages of using red seaweed?
So we started off with red seaweeds purely because that's what's being farmed at the moment. So there was a long history of them. There was a sizable body of science behind them that we could build on. And the farmers are accustomed to working with them. So honestly, that's the only reason we chose them. But it's worked out really well for us. And we see opportunities in the greens and the browns as well. But we chose the reds purely because that's the most commonly farmed groups in this region.
Yeah, that's fair enough. Are red seaweed, you feel, disproportionately underutilized when it comes to seaweed-based products?
I think so. At the moment, eucumetoids are only used for really one thing, which is carrageenan. So yeah, there's huge number of applications we can use that for. Whether it's animal feed like we're doing, or whether it's like bioplastic material or biofuels or biofertilizers or nutraceuticals. It's just being used just for one thing. That's it. But there's a lot of opportunity out there for new applications.
And so that links to what you were saying earlier, which is the importance of diversification and the potential of expanding into new species and varieties. It's an interesting one because it's something that, Europe and North America, we talk a lot about kelp, 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 and we forget about the red seaweed world. And I feel I'm fairly ignorant when it comes to these species and their potential. And I think the audience might be curious to learn about. So if there's anything that comes to mind that you think could be useful for people to understand.
Yeah, the only thing I would just encourage people in other parts of the world is to consider red seaweeds as a feedstock, whether it's a feedstock for like biostimulants or bioplastics or nutraceuticals, whatever it is. And if you are interested in this, then please reach out, because if we're really looking at a source of material that's scalable, then it's going to happen in this part of this world, and we can help with that. So if there's any companies or entrepreneurs in other parts of the world who are looking for a dependable source of raw material, red seaweeds, then please reach out and we're happy to have a chat with them.
Brilliant. And we'll put some contact details in the show notes for people to use and reach out. Simon, in wrapping up this wonderful conversation, is there anything you would like to mention that maybe we haven't brought up yet?
Well, the only thing I'd say is that we're always looking for smart people. If anyone's interested in growing in the seaweed industry and really wants to make a difference, then come out to our part of the world, come out to Southeast Asia and really create a bang.
Fantastic. So that's a very good call to action. Let me, for 30 seconds, explore that in more detail. What sort of people and roles? Is it all across the board?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say it's all across the board, but in particular, we're always looking for smart researchers. whether it's, you know, researchers in the field or researchers in the lab. We're always looking for engineering people, communications people. I think we've got a lot of that in this part of the world. But I'd say international scientific talent has always got a, will always have opportunities in this part of the world.
Okay, so communication and marketing, that's not an area you have an issue with?
No, there's plenty of people who can do that here.
Would you like to point the audience to any of your resources, website, any recommendations?
Please check out our website at www.seedling.com. That's SEADLING.com. We create seeds for the seed. Or follow us on LinkedIn. We like to share some valuable content on that. But if ever at a seaweed industry event and you see me around, you know, come and say hi. Always want to meet people.
Thank you so much for making the time, despite the time zone difficulties. I really appreciate it.
You're absolutely welcome, Fed. Thank you very much for having me.
It's been great talking to you. Fantastic to hear from someone with your experience and from a part of the world that, you know, and from a facet of the industry that, yeah, I think is often overlooked. And I personally don't feel like I understand. So I'm really glad we did this. Thank you for listening. And until next time, take care.